Okay. Hey, Randy, what's going on?
Hi, Jim.
How are you tonight?
Good. I'm looking forward to discussing the gravitational equivalence principles with you tonight.
What are the gravitational equivalence principles?
Apparently, it depends on who you ask. There's at least three and probably five. It depends on which of the two papers we're talking about. The first paper we're going to look at is The Theory of Gravitational Theories, a No Progress Report, which sounds kind of disparaging, but it's actually kind of interesting and really rigorous. And the next one is the non-equivalence of equivalence principles. In that one, they list five different equivalence principles, and we're going to get into the differences between them and what they mean.
That sounds really, really good. We'd like to start with this theory of gravitational theories. So why do we need a theory of gravitational theories? Was that clear to you?
They're very clear when they started the paper, talking about how there's really no axiomatic formulation of general relativity. But beyond that, the recent discoveries in cosmology, especially dark energy, are calling into question general relativity and causing a lot of investigation of alternatives that might be more inclusive that would also include dark energy. So in order to create sort of like a guidebook, theoretically, to figure out what theories, how theories are differentiated and what their basic operating principles are and that kind of thing, these authors wanted to take a look at what we know about the field of gravity and the equivalence principles that pertain to it, and see if they could use those to formulate categories of gravitational theories. And it turned out to be a much more hairy enterprise than they anticipated.
Okay, so we have some reason that we want to find some axiomatization of general relativity. And if you look at a lot of the tests of gravitation and the way people try to compare different theories, it really, really looks, and it looks more and more like general relativity is correct and all the other things don't work. People are doing all sorts of things and they're doing them for reasons. But in general, if you just look at the experimental tests keep sort of forcing you towards general relativity, where you have just this one gravitational metric and you don't have any additional sort of gravitational fields. You might have mass fields, but you don't have gravitational fields. You don't have that force field in addition. But like you said, we have all this dark energy stuff that's running around, and so people have gone back to alternative gravitational theories. And there's some other reasons for that as well. I mean, you have that one experimental reason, the dark energy and, the anisotropy and the cosmic microwave background and stuff like that. But you also have the whole idea that we want to at some point get to some sort of theory of everything or something. And you'd like to have a proper axiomatization of gravitation to be able to do that. So if you're using just sort of these equivalence principles that we use, these are good principles, but it's hard to turn those into mathematics. And it's hard to know exactly what they mean when you turn them into mathematics. I think that's a lot of what this particular paper is talking about.
Yeah, and they ultimately wanted to generalize the equivalence principles mathematically and axiomatically so that we could take a look at them in all kinds of different contexts, regardless of the nature of the theory that we are looking at. And there's alternative theories of gravity that don't talk about the space-time metric in the same way, and some that abandon the curvature of space-time altogether. And you'd sort of like to have a rule book to figure out which ones conform to the observations and which ones don't.
I mean, if you look at reference 12, that is almost a rule book. Reference 12 is something that we've talked about before. It was, if we'd ever finished Quantum Paradoxes, it was, I think, what we were planning on doing for the second book in that series, The Theory and Experiment in Gravitational Physics by Cliff Will, I think. And, if you look at that, he's done a lot of that work, but, to try to see how to compare things and how to compare specifically gravity to experiment. A lot of what these guys are talking about, these guys from Italy and Beirut, basically, I guess there's one guy from Quebec, they are trying to shed a little bit of doubt on the sort of things that Will did. And we'll find this out later. They're saying there's a lot of ambiguity in the choices for the metric and for these other scalar fields or vector fields or whatever that makes it difficult to compare, right? Because they say you're trying to do things from these general principles rather than trying to do these things from some sort of proper axiomatization, some sort of real mathematical approach.
Yeah, and they even talk about how there's a strong bias in the literature about how we talk about gravity. We're so enamored with general relativity, and not just the general theory of relativity, but also specific formulations that can be made from the theory that aren't always best applicable to the situation that, you know, they're looking at. So I think there is kind of a blinders on when we consider gravity, and I think they were attempting to tear that off a little bit.
I think this is good if there is this difficulty where you don't have things properly mathematically formulated, then if you can properly formulate them mathematically, you'll probably find something out. I mean, if you look at classical mechanics, right? Classical mechanics is all sort of built on these minimization principles, and you can build everything up in classical mechanics from these minimization principles, which are based on some very sound ideas in physics.
What do you mean by minimization principles?
Basically energy minimization or action minimization or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for the Lagrangian, you're minimizing the action.
Mm-hmm.
And for the Hamiltonian, you're minimizing the energy. And these things give you steady states and trajectories and so forth and so on in different situations.
Okay.
And they can also give you wave equations and blah, blah, blah. Well, I guess the thing that I was thinking a little bit, though, when these guys were saying we don't want to focus too much on these particular formulations, is that the formulations that people are putting things in are good for comparing the different situations. At least they're a standard format. Whether or not they're the best format for a given thing is a little more difficult. In fact, in this paper, it's a little sad because what they seem to be able to do is try to push things around. I'd like to talk about that a little bit later. There are a couple of things we ought to talk about first, but they're able to shift the meaning mathematically in some of these transformations that they do between different representations.
Yeah, that was really fascinating to see how the meaning of the mathematics changes and what that means to the equivalence principles.
I think probably the thing to do at this point, since we've mentioned the equivalence principles about 6 times in 6 minutes, I think maybe we ought to talk a little bit about this truncated set of equivalence principles used here. There's a larger set in the next paper, but we ought to at least just talk really quickly about these first three. So these three are all related in a hierarchy. One is more restrictive than the other, is more restrictive than the next. There's sort of a weak equivalence principle. The weak equivalence principle says that gravity doesn't affect other fields, that their preferred trajectory is under gravity, and if other fields don't impinge on an object, on a test object, technically, then they'll just follow those trajectories.
Well, right. And the emphasis there is that its trajectory will be independent of its internal structure and composition. So they're just saying that it doesn't matter what it's made of or how you arrange the matter. If it's, you know, if it's not interacting in any other field with any other fields, then it's going to follow a certain trajectory.
Which is what we generally see in Newtonian gravity. So then if you make that more strict, the way to make that more strict, you get sort of what is the Einstein equivalence principle. And in that case, you end up with everything that you had before.
You start with a weak equivalence principle and then you add on to that.
Yeah, you add on some local properties of the field. That is, if you make the field small enough, and how small it depends on your theory. So that could be an issue in different comparisons, but depending on how strong your gravity is and the way gravity couples to matter and stuff like that, you have a different size of this. But if you get something small enough, then you should end up with what's called local Lorentz invariance, which is basically a velocity independence. The laws of physics should always be the same in a local region. Also, you have a local position independence, which means that it doesn't matter which position you're at, the laws of physics are going to stay the same. And that's most of what you get. And that's more or less what gives you something that's a real gravitational theory for a nonlinear gravitational theory.
Oh, now the first one, they called it the local Lorentz invariance. Is that always restrictive to within a freely falling scenario?
Yeah, in all of these cases, the fact that it's local Lorentz invariant only has to do with the metric. Another way of looking at this is that the metric tensor goes to the metric of a Minkowski space. Everything becomes nice and linear at that limit. I think you mean the same thing as they do.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So yeah, I mean, the idea here is that you can add the additional fields on top of that. It'll act just like special relativity.
There was a really interesting comment in the second paper we'll get to about how that ties in with Einstein's theories in general that I really loved, but we'll get to that at the end.
And then for the strong equivalence principle, basically what it's saying is that the internal structure of the objects doesn't affect anything. So in one of these nonlinear theories, you know, the structure, if you have a large enough object, that's warping space-time as well. What this is saying is that if you have this large structure, it doesn't matter what's going on the inside of that structure. That size structure, that shape structure will always warp things in the same sort of way.
I was a little unclear about that. They're saying that the strong equivalence principle is basically the weak equivalence principle that's valid for self-gravitating bodies. Now, they're meaning that self-gravitating bodies of the same mass, right? Or I guess it doesn't even matter, does it? Because, well, let me think about that. It shouldn't. Because if they interact with, if they have a different level of gravity, then they're going to change the dynamics of the system, aren't they?
What it's trying to say is that the coupling isn't going to change.
Okay, yeah.
So that the gravitational physics doesn't change, not necessarily the local environment doesn't change. It's the physics that doesn't change. So the coupling won't change between matter and the field and things like that. So it's a little bit different than saying it's not going to affect space-time. It's just saying that the physics doesn't change. The way the self-gravitating body affects the world doesn't matter about the internal structure of the thing.
So the moon and Mars would collide differently with the Earth, but the underlying physics remains unchanged.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you don't have anything strange happening with one of these intermediate fields when you have multiple gravitational fields. At least that's how I understand it. Anyways, those are the three things. So there are claims that if the strong equivalence principle holds, then only general relativity can handle it. That's the only way to do it. That's not proven, that's not shown. They can sort of show in different restricted spaces that that's true, but they can't show it overall. You can't take the strong equivalence principle and derive general relativity from it. But the only thing that's been shown to satisfy the strong equivalence principle is general relativity, possibly with a cosmological constant.
Okay.
That's more or less what you end up having with that strong equivalence principle, is the Einstein equivalence principle restricts you to a certain set.
Non-gravitational tests, right?
Well, no, the Einstein equivalent principle still makes some very strong statements about gravity.
Yes.
But it's not as strong as strong equivalence principle. It doesn't restrict you to just one theory, or at least only one theory is known to satisfy it. Instead, it strong arms you into these metric theories, or at least that's what Will would say. I think here they're trying to show that that's not necessarily true because you have some choice in your representation. But Will would say, or Will has said, that if you have the Einstein equivalence principle, then you have one of these metric theories of gravity, whereas you could have some other kinds of theories of gravity if this Einstein equivalence principle does not hold. Then you get to what is a metric theory of gravity. Did you have a good strong idea about that?
Well, yeah, that's where they're talking about gravity just being a purely geometric phenomenon, right? So the idea is that there's matter, and then you look at the geometry of space-time, and a metric theory just allows the geometry of the space-time to dictate the motion of the matter.
Yeah, so it's all geometric. You end up with these metric postulates. These metric postulates should hold for every metric theory, or at least that's what, say, Thorne and Will would have said when they made them up. And so one of those postulates is basically that there's a metric. There's a second-rank tensor that tells you which way something wants to go and stuff like that. Secondly, there's sort of a divergencelessness of the stress-energy tensor. That's what basically makes a metric theory. You need a second-rank gravity.
What does it mean for the stress energy tensor to be divergentless?
Well, divergenceless in this case mean that if you take the correct kinds of derivatives, and I didn't check whether they're covariant derivatives or what, take the correct derivatives of the stress energy tensor, it's equal to zero. Because it's a tensor, it's a little bit more difficult for me to say exactly what it is, because I don't have that great idea. But if you look at the divergencelessness of an electric field or of a magnetic field, which is, of course, just a vector field, not a second-rank tensor field, so it's a first-rank field, in that case, that divergencelessness means there are no sources in empty space. So if you have nothing, then all of your fields are just going to basically keep on doing whatever they're doing as they're traveling along in space. So the divergencelessness is actually the absence of scalar sources. It could have vector sources. Divergencelessness means there are no scalar sources. So all magnetic fields, all non-changing magnetic fields, magnetostatic fields are always divergenceless because they only have vector sources. Already we end up with a problem. Or where we end up with two problems. So at this point, the problems they have are, what is the stress energy tensor?
Oh, how to define this stuff, yeah.
Yeah, so that apparently is not well known. And the other one is, what is a non-gravitational field anyway?
Right, that's a hypothetical construct, because anything with energy has gravity, right?
Yeah, well, I don't think that's what they're talking about. You know, they're talking about things like the matter field and stuff like that. But in a lot of these theories, you have additional fields. You have an additional scalar field, you have an additional vector field. What are they? How do they differ from a matter field or a gravity field? And how do they interact? How do they couple? Stuff like that.
Yeah, it's interesting that about the distinction there, because as we saw in these papers, that since the inertial mass and the gravitational mass are proportional to an arbitrary level of precision, can you really distinguish between them? And in the second paper, they just say, no, let's not distinguish between them. We'll just say they're the same. So that kind of, I don't know, that alone raises an interesting philosophical issue.
Really, this is close to what we were talking about when we were talking about the FR theories. So the FR theories end up with something that looks sort of like it could be a cosmological constant. The cosmological constant is actually a scalar field. It's not just a number, it's a scalar field. And that thing that they're getting out of the gravity, that can look like that cosmological constant in general relativity. In general relativity, that cosmological constant is not a gravitational field. Things don't couple to it. It doesn't have gravity. But in the FR theories, it looks like an additional gravitational field. Can you explain to me what's the difference between a theory and its possible representations? Because this is where things kind of get a little weird.
Well, let's see. The defining a theory and representation in this paper, they say, is kind of unclear to begin with. But the idea is that a physical theory is a coherent logical structure of axioms and the statements that you can derive from them, plus a set of rules for their interpretation that allow you to deduce and interpret the possible results of every experiment that falls within that scope. And then the representation, they had two different definitions of that. The first definition of representation of a theory is a finite collection of equations interrelating the physical variables, which are used to describe the elements of a theory and assimilate its axioms. So it looks like the theory itself is the collection of ideas that provide the bedrock for the expression. And then the representation is a mathematical expression of it, where you choose specific variables and you define them very clearly so that you can assimilate those axioms in a physically meaningful way in the laboratory. That's what I got out of it.
I think this is something like mathematical consistency. Mathematical consistency, as I recall from, you know, ancient days of yore, is shown by creating something that satisfies your axioms. So if you have, say, Euclid's five postulates, they were called postulates?
I can't remember what Euclid's five postulates are, but...
Well, you know, the most important one is it's the parallel postulate, right? That's the fifth postulate. It's important because you got rid of it. And then all of a sudden you had crazy geometries. So you had these five postulates, and to show that they're consistent, what you have to do is you have to create, you know, geometry in the plane to show that these postulates are consistent. That isn't too interesting, because just about all geometry that satisfies those five things is just Euclidean geometry. But then if you take away that fifth postulate, when you have those four around there, you can have different non-Euclidean geometries. And it turns out that in different regimes, you can have very different instances of a non-Euclidean geometry with a negative curvature, with a positive curvature, and so forth. You can have very different instances of it that are constructed in completely different ways. And even though you can prove things with those four postulates, you couldn't actually draw them from those postulates. So you have completely different geometries, all of which satisfy those four postulates. And I guess, in a way, each one of these representations for a theory is sort of like that. It's just a different mathematical way to write something that works with these axioms that don't necessarily exist, or don't exist according to these guys, I think.
Yeah, I guess the representations can be very different depending on how you want to go about defining all of your factors, right?
A lot of this paper from then on is talking about how to move from one representation to another, and turn one of these fields, never that second rank metric tensor, but one of these other ones, and turn it into a gravitational field, or turn it back into a matter field. I think that's what I got out of this. Is that what you recall?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They were highlighting the ambiguity in some representations that your metric can get mixed up with the matter field and vice versa. I think he even said in some representations it's not clear if the Einstein equivalence principle is satisfied, but, you know, the representations of the same theory, so that adds kind of a paradox.
So again, he's playing around with this. One of the things that he's been looking at is this scalar tensor gravity, which has this additional scalar field phi on top of the G field, the metric tensor.
And that FR theory that we talked about was one of those, right? Scalar tensor gravity.
Well, I mean, I guess that's what he's saying here. I mean, the FR theory, I think one of them, at least one of them, could be turned into a scalar tensor.
Yeah, the Palantini, I think it might have been.
Yeah, I don't remember if they all turned into it, because the FR theory itself is a class of theories. So if you have that FR equals to R, you just end up with general relativity. That's what I remember. I could be wrong, but I think that's what it is. But if you have something else, then you have this scalar tensor theory. But it may be you have a vector tensor as well, because you can have a vector tensor theory. These can violate certain tests that you do of relativity. So he went to these scalar tensor theories to look at them, because apparently they're popular, creating this scalar field. And he's looking at, say, Bronsdicki, which was equivalent to one of the FR theories. And he's saying that if you just look at it in its more natural frame, one, it manifestly satisfies all of the postulates that make up that metric theory. It is one of Will's metrics theories. It has that G, and the stress energy tensor is divergenceless. So he can switch between two different accelerated frames. Right, you should be able to do that. That's what general relativity is all about. You end up treating this scalar field as a matter field, sort of the way you look at the cosmological constant. But in another way, if you look at it, it turns into gravitational coupling. 1 over phi in the Bronsdicki theory is the gravitational coupling. If it's a gravitational coupling, then it's a gravity field. And that's why it's a scalar tensor theory, is that it's a gravity field. But you can fold that in the other frame, in what he's calling the Einstein frame, into the Ricci tensor. And then you no longer have that second scalar field, and you have something that's more like general relativity. You have something that's no longer a scalar tensor theory of gravity. I'm not sure how viable this trick is. He claims it's sort of a gauge theory kind of trick. He claims that it's just like choosing your gauge to a gradient of a divergenceless scalar field in magnetism. How much that's true, I don't really know, but that's definitely the claim here. And so this is where he's trying to show that you need some sort of interpretive rules as part of your theory. Your theory can't just be a bunch of principles. At some point, you have to be able to interpret those principles. Can't just be a bunch of equations. At some point, you have to be able to interpret those equations. Otherwise, you have some problems moving things around.
Yeah, that's what the general thrust of the paper was saying, was that without having this logical edifice that takes the principles and sets them up with a set of axioms to define a theory, which then leads to a representation, all you've got is what we have now, which is like just having observation to test whether or not the theory is valid. And in order to make our way through the forest of various gravitational theories, it would be helpful to be able to have a more structured theoretical edifice to compare them to. He also brings up the Jordan and Einstein frames as alternative representations of the same theory, right?
Well, yeah, those were the two frames I was talking about. So since I wasn't completely sure exactly what those two frames were, I didn't want to try to get too deep into what the difference between the Jordan and the Einstein frame actually is.
Okay, that's fine.
Unless you know exactly what they are, and then you can explain it to me.
Let me see. It says in the Jordan frame, some symbol that I didn't get couples explicitly to the Ricci scalar. And then in the Einstein frame, it's not coupled to the Ricci scalar. It's actually minimally coupled to gravity and non-minimally coupled to matter. Let me see if I can find out what that little symbol is. Oh, yeah, it's just the scalar. In the Jordan frame, the scalar couples explicitly to the Ricci scalar. One could therefore say that the scalar is a gravitational field and not a matter field. In the Einstein frame, however, phi is not coupled to the scalar. It is actually minimally coupled to gravity and non-minimally coupled to matter. So I guess these are just two different ways of expressing general relativity, right?
Yeah, these are two different ways to deal with that scalar field. I was hoping that there was a little bit more about what they actually were. How do you interpret that different phi? So again, I don't have any clear idea about physically what the difference between the two representations or the two frames is. Is there some sort of rotation? Is there a velocity difference? Is there an acceleration difference? Is there something physically that makes the two different frames, which I'd assume there is. So I think that's pretty much all we've got for this paper. Everything else are particulars and examples. And this paper is really just trying to say that our representations are sort of a bias to what we're thinking about these different theories. They're more or less calling for a program of pushing all of these different representations into categories that all have the same axiom, so that each one of these theories, even if they end up being different in practice, each one of these representations, even though they end up being different in practice, are all just representations of the same theory. If you want to examine the viability of the theory, you don't want to just look at one representation, because you could pick a particularly poor representation that doesn't necessarily correspond to what it actually is. You've got a particular way of writing the metric tensor. You have a particular way of deriving that second gravitational field. You have a particular way of dealing with this in the action. But that might not be the only representation, the only way to do that that satisfies the axioms of the theory.
Yeah, and as they noted earlier, our experimental tests really are tests of principles anyway. If we can clarify what those principles are, then we'll have a better idea about what we're testing and what's compatible with those principles.
And at the end, they say these principles that we have, these equivalence principles, these metric postulates and stuff, are not as useful as people had previously thought or people think.
Yeah, it's one of the things I loved about this paper is, I mean, I'd always thought that the equivalence principles were locked down and they were solid and there wasn't any question about what they meant. And then suddenly, after reading this paper, you're like, oh, wait a minute. When you really do take a hard look at the definitions and how it works into the final mathematical representation, there are a lot of questions to ask.
Yeah, so there's still a lot of stuff going on there dealing with this. So somehow we have to get to a point where we have axioms that we're talking about our theories axiomatically, and then we can avoid all the slipperiness that happens when you're not sure exactly what it is you're talking about. So you want to go on to the different equivalence principles?
Yeah, the non-equivalence of equivalence principles paper. I noticed that Stefano Liberati was an author on both of these. Is that just a coincidence, or were you studying him in particular?
I had been reading Will's book when I found these, and I got to chapter 7 or wherever it was, where he starts talking about particular experiments and it's giving me tolerances and stuff like that as of 1980-something. I was thinking, okay, well, how do these tolerances look for all of these different little parameters in what he was calling the parameterized post-Newtonian framework? Which is just a way to look at different experiments in the solar system. So you take a generalized form of all of the different kinds of metric theories that are viable, and then you look at how they interact in a weak field limit. Then you look at all of these different parameters. I think you get half a dozen parameters. And you look at what the limits of those parameters are in light of different experiments, time delay experiments, what happens with a binary pulsar and stuff like that. You look at all these different limits or limits on those parameters, and then you should be able to look at those limits on those parameters and then decide what are the viable theories. So I was Googling around and looking for something that had to do with where we are today. And I found that Will had written a paper maybe 2 years ago that has updated information about all that. And I found this paper, The Non-Equivalence of Equivalence Principles. And I thought that maybe we'd want to talk about equivalence principles or something like that. That might be the kind of thing that we talk about on the show. And so that's how all this got to you.
Oh, it's a good find. So it was just totally serendipitous that you ended up with two papers with the same guy listed as an author. But in the subsequent paper that we're going over now looks like a sort of natural growth from the paper that we just went over from 2008.
Now, I think the first paper is coming out of one of those guys' dissertation. I'm not completely sure, but that's what it looked like to me when I was looking through the notes and stuff like that. This non-equivalence of equivalence principles, I didn't get that opinion. Instead, it looks like they're just going through these different equivalence principles and trying to show how they relate to one another.
And I felt like they found more structure and did a more developed analysis of how they all relate to each other and everything in this paper than the first one. The first one raised a lot of great questions, and this one seems to be adding a little bit of structure to how the equivalence principles are all related.
Yeah, I wasn't sure how much was actually new in this. The thing about it is a lot of this comes from basically that Will book, and that Will book basically comes from those papers we were talking about with Thorne and Will talking about testing gravitational theories. Will has a chapter on equivalence principles. So part of the reason why I wanted to look at this was to sort of see the differences in the way that these guys were talking about it. So I guess, you know, the really new stuff is in the concluding remarks, which are two or three pages, and possibly a little bit of discussion in the theoretical role of the equivalence principles. The part that's the meat, the part that I think is the most interesting, I think most of that, just this description of the equivalence principles, I think that was not really that new. He was trying to put these in a particular form so that they were all sort of in the same form and they were okay with all of the different ways that people talk about these things. Fortunately, this is physics and it's not anthropology, so it's only like a 10-page paper instead of a 700-page paper. I mean, I told you, you know, in like 1980-whatever, or maybe 1990-something, I was wandering through the stacks, looking through different journals, and I found a paper on the use of the word culture. And it was trying to do the same thing that this guy's doing for the equivalence principles, only with only one concept, which is culture. And he ended up having over 100 different definitions of culture that he found in the literature. And that was in the 90s. By now, there are probably 1,500. In this case, he's just talking about the different equivalence principles. And it turns out that they have a fairly reasonable hierarchy. In fact, it's sort of split up into a couple of groups. It's hard to say what we really want to call a equivalence principle. They are set up into these different groups. So why don't you tell me about how you see these different equivalence principles relating to each other?
Well, first we should probably mention what they are. In this paper, there's 5 different equivalence principles, and I've never seen this one called Newton's equivalence principle before. But Newton's equivalence principle is the equivalence between inertial mass and gravitational mass.
This is what you normally think of when you think of the equivalence principle, is that gravitational and inertial mass are the same thing. All these other things that we were talking about are stronger versions of that same statement.
And then the next one, of course, is the weak equivalence principle, and that's the universality of free fall. And then he has one here called the gravitational weak equivalence principle, which says that, you know, test particles behave in a gravitational field and in vacuum independently of the properties.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about how the strong equivalence principle related to the Einstein equivalence principle previously. This is the same sort of thing. The gravitational weak equivalence principle says exactly what the weak equivalence principle says, but it also says that it doesn't matter how the parts of the object are interacting. So technically, the weak equivalence principle is for something that doesn't have a big effect on the gravitational field. Whereas the gravitational weak equivalence principle, that particle doesn't have to be a test particle. It can be a particle that can affect the gravitational field. But even though it can affect the gravitational field, it doesn't change the gravitational physics. So a lot of the reason why there's a gravitational weak equivalence principle is so that you can write sort of axiomatically the Einstein equivalence principle in the same way as the strong equivalence principle and have the first of the three things in there be the gravitational weak equivalence principle is satisfied. Just like for the Einstein equivalence principle, we said the first thing that it was important for that is that the weak equivalence principle is satisfied. That's its role anyway.
Okay. And then there's the Einstein's equivalence principle, which we know about already, which is that, you know, within a gravitational field, the laws of physics operate the same as if you're not within a gravitational field, basically. And then the strong equivalence principle, let's say all fundamental physical tests, maybe I got that wrong, fundamental non-gravitating test physics is not affected by gravity. But in the strong equivalence principle, all fundamental tests of physics are unaffected by the presence of gravity. So there's a little distinction there.
And again, for the weak equivalence principle, it's saying that the electric field isn't going to change the gravitational field, or it won't change the way the gravitational field couples to the matter. It might affect the gravitational field because, as an electric field, it has mass. But how it changes the gravitational field is going to be part of that same interaction that a massive body would, and it'll do that in the same way. You just have to figure out what the energy density of that field is and do the integral. So the strong equivalence principle says that's true for gravity as well.
Then they start talking about the relationship between the various formulations. They talk about how the weak equivalence principle implies the Newtonian equivalence principle. And I guess that makes sense because, you know, masses are going to behave the same in a gravitational field. And they also said in an empty background, the gravitational weak equivalence principle implies the Newtonian equivalence principle for self-gravitating bodies.
Yeah, so that's actually a sixth equivalence principle, is that he said there's this gravitational Newtonian equivalence principle, which is apparently different from the Newtonian equivalence principle. I'm not sure how interesting that is, but he said it was tested by laser ranging.
Yeah, he said apparently the Brons-Dickey theory fails with the gravitational Newtonian equivalence principle.
Yeah, I think the Brons-Dickey theory fails somewhere. The thing is that the coupling omega ends up having to be really, really strong in that Brons-Dickey theory. And again, the Brons-Dickey theory doesn't satisfy this particular thing. That's not surprising at this point.
And I think later on he says that they've illustrated that only a metric formulation of gravitation satisfies the equivalence principles, and that if you add a scalar to it, that it won't work. But I'm not sure if that's a solid conclusion.
I think that is generally accepted. I think based on those solar system experiments, that's true. I think I got that out of Will. Maybe it might not be for Brons-Dickey itself.
But isn't it possible for a theory to reproduce the apparent effects of metric curvature without it being a metric curvature using a different field coupling mechanism like we saw with G4V?
You know, looking at some of these things, I'd like to look at that. I'd like to look a little more deeply into that. According to Will, at least, that is not the case. Anything that has a fixed background fails for particular reasons. And that might be just if you're assuming that it has to satisfy the Einstein equivalence principle.
Oh, okay, that might be it.
But G4V definitely does not satisfy the Einstein equivalence principle because it has that background.
It has a flat background.
Yeah. Now, what I wanted to look at with the G4V was whether or not, instead of being a universal theory of gravity, it ends up just being valid in the post-Newtonian limit, so that the post-Newtonian limit is, you know, things don't get too fast and things don't get too massive, but they're too fast or too massive to be just Newtonian. So you don't have really strong nonlinearities, but you have something that is not Newtonian, not completely linear.
Yeah, but he did some calculations and was able to come to within observational error on some pretty extreme cases, like a high-density binary system. I think he calculated the gravitational radiation and the orbital decay to within observational error.
Yeah, but for these cosmologists, that's still sort of a low-energy regime. Yeah, I think gravitational radiation might be the only place where things are really strong enough that it doesn't matter, or that things are really strong enough that you can't use the post-Newtonian framework.
Okay, in this section of this paper, he also gets into the Schiff's conjecture. Schiff's conjecture, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, so Schiff's conjecture says that any theory that satisfies the weak equivalence principle is actually going to satisfy the Einstein equivalence principle as well. And then by association, anything that satisfies the gravitational weak equivalence principle is going to satisfy the strong equivalence principle. And that's been shown to hold true for certain restricted situations. There's just no general proof of it right now. So it might not really, really be true, but at least in all the places where people have figured out that they can show whether or not it's true, it has succeeded, yeah.
Did you want to talk more about the relationship of these different equivalence principles? There's quite a lot of different correlations and so forth they enumerate here, but I'm not sure if they're particularly useful.
So you want to talk about correlations between them?
Well, I mean, they say various things about how if you add the gravitational weak equivalence principle to the Einstein equivalence principle, one recovers the full strong equivalence principle. You know, they show a lot of these relationships between the different equivalence principles in a formulaic kind of way.
I think we've already been through most of that. I think the only interesting thing left here is probably the most interesting part of this paper, which is talking about sort of the theoretical role of each one of these equivalence principles. Like the weak equivalence principle, it hints that the gravitational field is described by an affine connection on spacetime. That rule for parallel transport is how the gravitational field should be described. So the weak equivalence principle is already saying that, right? And then the Einstein equivalence principle says that the metric must have an affine connection. And it has some really strange things that they started talking about, like the chronogeometric measurements cannot reveal the presence of a gravitational field. So next time you're making any chronogeometric measurements to reveal the presence of a gravitational field, just remember that it's not going to work, okay? Don't be sad when it fails.
And you mean, is that in the sense that you can't distinguish between whether your measurements are telling you that you're accelerating or that you're in a gravitational field?
I think that's what they're saying, that all accelerations are equivalent to a gravitational acceleration. But apparently that's in there, but it's not the end-all be-all. So a lot of people seem to think that that's all the Einstein equivalence principle is saying, but that's just a sort of part of it that you get for free. It's much more stringent than that. And it's starting to talk about the kinds of conditions you can have on Green's functions. So it says the way that gravity responds to an impulse, and I'm not really sure what that impulse would be in this case, because, you know, we're talking about four-dimensional space-time, have to have a local structure that is satisfied by this principle. And it's sort of the gravitational weak equivalence principle that requires purely metric theories, and you can't have any additional gravitational fields. So it's not the strong equivalence principle itself that's saying that. It's this weaker version of it that doesn't care about Lorentz invariance and doesn't care about local position invariance. Just that you have that gravitational weak equivalence principle gets rid of the scalar theories like the Bronz-Dickey theory, scalar tensor theories, vector tensor theories. They're all gone. You don't have any other gravitational fields, although we just said that it's all a matter of perspective, right? According to this, everything's purely metric and gravity has to be nonlinear. The strong equivalence principle gets us back to its only general relativity, at least probably, because, you know, people have been able to show in certain situations that's true, but they haven't been able to show it universally in general. Although, if you have more than four dimensions, if you have five or more dimensions, you can have different things and additional fields and stuff like that. So for anybody who's still holding out hope that we're going to find another dimension or two, that's available.
Those would open up all kinds of fascinating possibilities. But boy, I don't think the dark energy gives us any evidence for it. Do we have any evidence for a higher dimension?
No, not really. But at minimum, looking at higher dimensions gives you some information about what kind of restrictions you've put on in the lower dimensional situations. So looking at things in the less restrictive context is usually a reasonable way to get an idea about what's really going on in the more restrictive context.
Yeah, there was an interesting comment pertains to that where they said that the Einstein equivalence principle can be turned into a prescription for writing the physical laws in a gravitational field once they are known in Minkowski spacetime.
Yeah, I mean, we've got all these different things going on. I think that pretty much says it all about the equivalence principles, unless you've got something really, really interesting that you saw.
Well, yeah, in the concluding remarks, he explained something which I guess hadn't seen said quite as clearly as this before, but he was saying that this special theory of relativity was to show that the laws of physics are invariant under velocity transformations, and the general theory of relativity shows that the laws of physics are invariant under acceleration transformations. So, and even that different velocity frames are he showed the relationship between them, how they're equivalent, and how different accelerated frames are equivalent. And that's why he called it the general theory, because he went from velocity to acceleration. I thought that was interesting. That was nice and clear.
Yeah, that is nice to talk a little bit about that. Okay, so are we experts?
Not in the least. This is some pretty heady stuff. You know, you're going into basically the philosophy of really the most complicated theories that we know that requires an entirely different way of looking at the world, you know, general relativity. So it's tough to get through this in some cases, but it's really fascinating stuff. You know, it's good to get a look under the hood at how theorists look at these problems.
Yeah, and we should mention that if you're listening to this program, right, and if you know what the three axioms of gravitation should be, put them in the comments.
And we'll credit you when we get our Nobel Prize.
That's right. Unless you've got anything more, I think it's a good time to wind up.
Yeah, this has been good. Thank you so much for bringing these papers together and having us cover them together, because, you know, I've always enjoyed thinking about the equivalence principles, and I'm intrigued by tests of them. And it's nice to see how they all relate to each other and what their meaning is for gravity theories.
Okay, well, thanks for talking.
All right, James, we'll see you again next time.
Okay, bye now.
Good night.